It's here. It's there. It's everywhere. Russian military intelligence, the GRU, stands accused of hacking American elections, poisoning people in the UK, mounting commando operations in Syria, and most recently, turning a French lieutenant colonel who's working for NATO. Today, then, I want to talk about this seemingly omnicompetent, or maybe omni-incompetent, GRU. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow's shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency, and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons, who also receive extra perks and bonuses appropriate to their tier. If you'd like to join them, just head on to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. But now, on with today's programme. When the news broke that Alexei Navalny had been poisoned by Novichok, the same nerve agent family the GRU used to try and poison Sergei Skripal, one of their own turned a British double agent, some began speculating that it had been military intelligence that had gone after him. Now, I don't believe so. It's not their role, not their kind of target. And anyway, they probably didn't and don't have Novichok themselves. The only covert poison laboratories likely to be in operation are actually connected with the SVR, the Foreign Intelligence Service, and the FSB, the Federal Security Service. But I can understand why some might have been so quick to put the GRU in the frame, given that they have been frankly hogging Western media attention for some time. So I thought it might be worth giving a bit of an overview of this organisation, its role, its activities, and its culture, and explode a myth or two on the way. But first, a pedantic word on nomenclature. GRU stands for Glavnoye Razvedivatelnoye Upravlenie, or Main Intelligence Directorate. The GRU is part of the General Staff apparatus in theory and in practice, although it is more than just that and has its own very extensive headquarters in northwestern Moscow. Its director has the right to brief Putin personally, and generally it's more of a semi-autonomous part of the General Staff. And also a rather more anonymous one now, since in 2010, for reasons frankly still unclear, it was renamed the GU, simply the Main Directorate of the General Staff. A very, very uninspiring title, and particularly given that there are other main directorates, from everything from operations to mobilisation, it's a very strange framing, and as I say, I honestly have no good answer as to why it was done. Indeed, back in 2018, Putin himself said he didn't know why it was done and suggested the R might return. In any case, everyone in Russia, from Putin downwards, still calls it GRU, GRU, so I'll do likewise. Besides, the real issue was not the R, but the G. In other words, its prior status as a main rather than just regular directorate of the General Staff. Back in 2010, after all, the service was looking in a really tight spot. And such is the carnivorous, cannibalistic nature of Russian security politics that its rivals were getting out their knives and forks because they were sensing a potential buffet in the offering. And at that point, it might well have just simply been demoted to being a regular directorate and lose a lot of its clout and autonomy in the process. So why was this? Because in the 2009 Georgian War, the GRU, perhaps a little unfairly, was regarded as having underperformed. Abandoned airfields had been bombed on GRU targeting data. Georgian troops performed rather better than GRU assessments had predicted. Sure, Russia won the war, but that had never been in doubt when it was taking on a country with a total population the third the size of Moscow cities. But it hadn't won as well as it should in Moscow's eyes, and a scapegoat was needed. That's when you need a service chief with the kind of sharp elbows and equally sharp political skills to fight your corner. What the GRU had was General Alexander Shlakhturov, not the most dynamic figure at the best of times, and in any case, on medical leave on the whole these days, or those days rather. Then Shliakhturov retired in 2011, and everything changed, because he was succeeded by General Igor Sergun. The next few years would see the GRU go from strength to strength. First of all, this was thanks to Sergun himself, who was an able, articulate, and frankly unprincipled man, just the kind of chap you need to turn an intelligence agency's fortunes around. I once heard an account of his briefing the political leadership. Now, bear in mind, this is not a man who had seen active combat as best we know. Apparently, anyway. I mean, he did have the Order of Combat Merit, but certainly no one was able to actually point to any real military experience. Rather, he had been essentially a defence attaché until he was posted to the GRU's headquarters. But still, he apparently played the soldier's role to the hilt. There he was, at this briefing, in full uniform, with his medals, and began by apologising, quote-unquote, very sorry-not-sorry kind of way, for being a blunt soldier who tells it as he sees it. And then proceeded to give one of the most carefully calibrated political briefings possible, playing to every potential interest, indulging every prejudice, flattering every assumption of the people in the room. And of course, they loved it. Who doesn't? Now, this was politically brilliant. In such a personalised, deinstitutionalised system, the best way to thrive is precisely to be popular with the big boys. And it worked. But, and here's something that it's worth coming back to at some other point in the future, because it was successful in turning the GRU's fortunes around at the cost of kicking off what we could call a rhetorical arms race within the intelligence services, as they all began to compete to tell the political leadership the most lurid, the most exciting, the most conspiratorial tales of the outside world. The true function of an intelligence agency is to provide these political decision makers with their best truth, without fear or favour. One can, after all, then debate whether, in his determination to advance the GRU's interests, Sergun actually betrayed his motherland. And it's precisely this kind of rhetorical arms race, the perception of the world as this dangerous place full of anti-Russian conspiracies, that does so inform Putin and his circle's political decision-making these days, very much for the worse. Now, the second key factor behind the resurgence of the GRU was the appointment of Sergei Shoigu as defense minister in 2012. I'm going to profile Shoigu in a future podcast, but suffice it to say, he is one of the most politically deft and heavy-hitting big beasts in the system. And in the GRU, he saw an asset, and he certainly wasn't going to see it wasted, much less its various resources shared out between other agencies. Because, and this is the third reason for the GRU's phoenix-like revival, the times they were changing, and in ways that absolutely suited this agency. To understand why, you need to understand just what the GRU is. In some ways, there are four of them. There's the GRU that is a conventional military intelligence arm, getting information on potential enemies' military capabilities and technologies through the usual sneakiness, including agents posing as defence attachés and the like. Secondly, there is a substantial electronic intelligence gathering network. At first, this meant satellites and listening stations, but in fact, it now also increasingly means cyber espionage too. Thirdly, there's also the Spetsnaz, Russia's special forces, who are subordinated to the GRU, and which mean that this is an agency which is also a battlefield and sabotage force. There's a lot of mythology about the Spetsnaz, and this idea that they're all these sort of 7-foot-tall, knife-between-teeth, super-assassins and generally Slavic ninjas. Well, look, there's about 17,000 of them. You can't have 17,000 ninjas, I'm afraid. The thing about the Spetsnaz is that many of them really are only moderately special. In fact, a lot of them are conscripts. Broadly speaking, they're essentially very good light infantry and expeditionary forces. If anything, they're closer to the British Paras or the American Rangers or the French Foreign Legion. Not at all bad, better than your ordinary Russian soldier, but not the kind of SAS SEAL Team 6 type. Within those numbers, though, there are rather better ones, including the kind of Tier 1 Special Forces, particularly in what's called the Special Operations Command. So we should remember that whereas all Spetsnaz are special, some Spetsnaz are definitely more special than others. Anyway, that was a little sort of sideline. The fourth element of the GRU is there's also a big analytical side to it, which works with the rest of the general staff, briefing the Kremlin and so forth. So it covers everything from people on the battlefield all the way up to the analytic briefers via hackers and defense attachés turned spies. In that context, because it's so big and has such a breadth of roles and activities and capabilities in a country which, after all, isn't well known for skimping on its spooks, that gives it a particular weight of its own. And because of the presence of the Spetsnaz, it also has a particular culture, a gung-ho, risk-taking, complete-the-mission regardless of the costs, regardless of what gets broken on the way kind of culture. I once met an ex-GRU officer, let's be honest, a man who had spent his pretty much all of his career beyond his obligatory first couple of years in the infantry, actually as a translator, then a defence diplomat. And he probably these days, well, those days, knew how to handle a canapé rather better than a Kalashnikov. But nonetheless, he said, look, we all like to think of ourselves as Spetsnaz. And I think that's true. The KGB, for example, back in Soviet times, used to look down on their uncultured GRU counterparts and calling them sapogi, boots. Well, I think what's happened is that the GRU has turned this around, made their tough soldierly nature a virtue rather than a stigma. And much of the supposed clumsiness of or amateurishness, frankly, of operations like the attempted assassination of Sergei Skripal, actually reflects this mindset. They're careless of the diplomatic fallout. They don't really bother about what gets broken on the way. Historically, after all, the GRU has always been the arm of choice in what we could consider uncontrolled spaces. Saboteurs operating behind enemy lines in wartime. The guys you send in to train rebels in a civil war, or, if you're on the other side, hunt them down. In Afghanistan, in Chechnya, they've always been at the forefront in these kind of rough territories. Well, welcome to the New World Disorder, where most places these days seem to be uncontrolled, including, of course, cyberspace. And fortuitously for the GRU, the whole world was about to get even more uncontrolled. They had a good, well, not war, but annexation in Crimea in 2014. To a considerable extent, it was handled by Spetsnaz and two plans in which the GRU played quite a crucial role. Then they were also going to play a very serious role standing up, arming and directing local militias in this deniable war in the Donbass. Everything from genuine locals to gangs of Russian volunteers and Spetsnaz commando teams pretending to be locals. Then came yet another scruffy, knee-in-the-groin kind of war in Syria from 2015. And meanwhile, the growing political war with the West. Look, these are just the kind of messy environments, messy conflicts in which the GRU feels most at home. And therefore, in this new world, all of a sudden, the GRU took centre stage. So I'd suggest these are all the reasons why we've been hearing so much about them these days. It's not necessarily that they've been more active than the SVR, the Foreign Intelligence Service, or even the FSB, which, while technically a domestic security agency, has been increasingly and aggressively operating abroad. Rather, first of all, commentators default to what they know. The GRU seems to have been behind the original hack of Democratic emails in the 2016 American presidential elections, so every hack is blamed on them. The GRU tried to poison Sergei Skripal with Novichok in Salisbury, so every killing or attempted killing, especially ones with Novichok, must be GRU. Now, in fact, yes, the GRU hacked those emails, But there had been a second parallel operation also in the field, probably being carried out by the SVR, and it wasn't the GRU that actually came up with the idea of leaking them. Likewise, look, because Skripal was an ex-GRU guy, it was their business. But the earlier assassination of Alexander Litvinenko in London with polonium had been an FSB operation, because Litvinenko had been an FSB guy. And most recently, we saw the shooting of the Chechen Zelim Kangoshvili in Berlin at the end of last year, which was almost certainly an FSB operation. So, you know, again, people may assume that. There is a tendency to assume that everything is about the GRU, and also to magnify its activities. But that's more of a journalistic artifact than anything else. This was, for example, particularly evident in some reportage about one of its teams, known as Unit 29155. Why that? Well, look, for reasons of security, all GRU units are known by their five-digit military postcode. It's a postbox number, really. And this identifies them in such a way as just as easily if one had just given them, say, room numbers or whatever. It makes it harder for outsiders to know exactly who they are, how large an organisation this is, how it's subordinated and such like, compared with, say, if it had been called, I don't know, the second section of Department P of the Third Directorate or whatever. Anyway, to some, Unit 29155 has been some kind of all-purpose destabilisation and subversion team, operating all across Europe and North America, doing everything from hacking to subverting political systems to actually carrying out wet work, as the jargon is for acts of killing. To me, this unit is essentially one of their action teams, the heavies that you send in for a killing or a poisoning. Or to put it another way, other people may well be coming up with all kinds of complex political war plans. These may be the guys you send in to execute, pun possibly intended, the actual plan itself. But they're not really at the heart of it. They're just people who do, heavies who do what they're told to do. But the mythology of this all-purpose political warfare specialist team fomenting unrest here is just too appealing. So, in a way, what happened is the GRU has become too tempting a brand. Now, the second reason why the GRU seem to be everywhere is this culture that I mentioned. They are much less bothered about being uncovered or about making a scandal. For them, it's all about the mission. The GRU, like the other intelligence agencies in Russia, are operating at an incredibly high tempo, pretty comparable to the height of the Cold War. Now, look, in such circumstances, you can't just use your A team. You've also got to turn to your B and maybe even your C teams. And you're going to have failures. The more operations you run, the more failures you're going to have. This is, in many ways, a crucial difference between the current Russian and Western intelligence mindsets. The Russian agencies are essentially operating on a wartime footing. Never mind if not everything works. Never mind if there's some political fallout. You seize opportunities and remember that it's okay to lose battles as long as you win the war. Conversely, Western agencies are still operating by peacetime rules, I'm very glad to say. They are much more concerned about potential failure, potential fallout. They're therefore much more conservative. So many things that they could do, they don't, precisely because of the dangers within it. So we hear about the GRU and the other Russian agencies more because they're doing more, but also because they're taking more risks and they're not really caring about the overall fallout. And Putin seems right behind this. Sergun died unexpectedly on the 3rd of January 2016. And there was some feverish speculation in some quarters that he'd actually been killed in some secret mission in Lebanon or whatever. Now, I think that's absolutely nonsense, I should say. As I understand it, it's rather an object lesson in why you shouldn't be macho and go cross-country skiing after you've had heart surgery. He was succeeded by General Igor Korobov, who was more of an analyst than either an action man or a military diplomat. 2 years on, though, Korobov died, and this time the rumour mills really began cranking. It was, some claimed, punishment for the bungled Skripal operation a few months before. Yeah. Look, this is not a Bond movie. People do have this image that Putin will, after some operational failure, call in the relevant director and you'll have one of those. You have failed me for the last time, general moments, before he presses a button to dump the poor individual into the piranha tank. Yeah, works well on film, but not in real life. Unless we're talking about some particularly extreme cases like North Korea or Idi Amin's Uganda, the sort of lunocracies. Yes, I have just invented that word, where basically it is ruled by the craziest. In sensible states, they don't do that. At worst, you sack, demote, or just generally remonstrate with the individual concerned. Otherwise, well, first of all, it deters smart people from actually rising within your system. Why put yourself in the firing line or the piranha line? And secondly, it actually also encourages coups and defections. Let's be honest, if you know that you're about to be dumped into a piranha tank, the temptation is to do something to avoid that. The fact of the matter is that Korobov had been ill for a while, and this was just something that happens. Besides, there's actually no evidence that Putin was furious about the Skripal case, the fact that it failed, and that there was a consequent great big amount of political fallout. He does seem to understand at least one basic point about intelligence, and that is that not everything works. And there's no sign of any fury on his part. In November 2018, he gave a speech at a gala event to mark the GRU's 100th anniversary. I read this speech over time and time again, trying to find even the slightest hint of a veiled critique, something layered between the lines to even show that he wanted them to know that they had screwed up. I saw nothing. I saw nothing except a panegyric to this service and how amazing its people are and how successful it's been. And to me, what that says is actually the GRU is doing what Putin wants. And yes, of course, he would prefer clearly that every mission works. But even when it doesn't succeed, it still also succeeds on a second level, as a message. This is something I've talked about in previous podcasts, but I think it's important to stress the extent to which the signalling of such operations counts. The fact that they're willing to do things that other countries would not risk doing conveys a basic point. The Russians are trying to show that they are not reasonable, that their message is this: do not mess with us because we will not observe the same rules as you. We will not be sensible. We are willing to take all kinds of risks to make our enemies bleed. So in that respect, even the failures of the GRU do convey this sense of Russia as a dangerous, adventurous power. Now, its current head, the current head of the GRU, is Admiral Igor Kostyukov. In fact, it's worth mentioning the first naval officer appointed to this position. And he's a man with a broad range of experiences. He was Korobov's deputy. He certainly played a significant role in Syria, for which he appears to have been awarded the Hero of the Russian Federation Medal, which is equivalent to, say, the Victoria Cross or the like. And you know, he is probably also one of the key figures behind the GRU's acquisition of substantial cyber capabilities. So he has quite a breadth to him. He's certainly not a dove, not a man to reverse the GRU's current course. So I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about it in the future, but let's not lose track of the context. First of all, these are neither the keystone cops of the espionage world, nor are they super spies. You know, it's a competent agency, but in some ways I would say it's being pushed to its limits, and that will tell. Secondly, the culture is crucial. The SVR officers are typically embedded within embassies. They're the classic, you know, diplomatic cover, you know, second cultural attaché, secretary to the economic section, whatever. Inevitably, some of the culture of the diplomatic service rubs off on them, and they are a little bit more aware about their diplomatic implications of what they do. The GRU as soldiers, they don't really care. They will lean towards seizing opportunities and frankly not care if that causes messes that the diplomats are then going to have to clear up. Thirdly, this world is not a controlled space, quite the opposite. These days it has become a GRU playground, and from their point of view, they're very much going to be out for play. That's my brief snapshot of the GRU. Now a break, and then a very definite change of pace. Just the usual reminder, you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. You can support it by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the show. I want to talk a bit about Putin's personality, and one very, very specific aspect of it. After all, look, it's really terribly hard to delve at all usefully into him, how he thinks, what his assumptions are, given how sealed his environment is. But at the same time, I think it's phenomenally important. After all, look, we can talk as much as we want about laws and institutions, but ultimately these are made, defined, and used by people. And they're therefore going to be shaped by their worldviews, their quirks, their personalities, their paranoias, their relationships, their expectations, and their night terrors. This is why, after all, I certainly don't want people to think that I'm necessarily dissing the role of political science, but I think at the same time we need to consider what we could think of as political psychology. And here I feel historians have a bit of the edge. But then again, of course I would. Back in February, political impresario and all-round smartass Vladislav Surkov was finally sacked after basically falling downward from presidential aide and architect of the sort of modern system of fake theatrical politics down to representative to the war-torn Donbass. That last appointment was frankly never a good fit, putting the urbane and cultured Surkov amidst the hard men of the Donbass was a little bit like making me coach of an inner-city youth football team. It's just not going to work. In the September issue of the literary journal Ruski Pioner, a poem of his was published, and it began, "I'm alone again. I was given freedom. Who needs cocaine when there's this air?" Now, with Surkov, you never really know what's real, what's a pose. But this certainly doesn't sound like a man ruining his exclusion from the hallowed halls of Staraya Ploshad, Old Square, the site of the presidential administration. But perhaps no wonder, as it later emerged that he'd been petitioning for some time to be allowed to leave government service. Whether it was because he was tired of it, or wanted to find some more lucrative business opportunity, or whatever, doesn't really matter. It's that he had to try and try again to be allowed to leave. And that's what's got me thinking. Foreign Minister Lavrov has been trying for years to be allowed to retire. And frankly, since 2014, since the Crimean annexation, he has been increasingly not just marginalised within the political system, but embarrassed abroad because he's more and more being used as the spokesman for wholly untenable and frankly wholly implausible policy. Yevgeny Murov, head of the FSO, the Federal Protective Service, had to petition Putin for 5 years to be allowed to retire, and eventually did in 2016 at the age of 70. That same year, Sergei Ivanov, who had been Putin's head of the presidential administration, and at one point considered to be a potential successor, semi-retired, exchanging Staraya Ploshad for a much less significant position as special presidential representative on environmental matters. Not just a sinecure, it's worth mentioning, Ivanov is actually quite serious about conservation. Anyway, the urbane and frankly quite impressive Ivanov had apparently lost his appetite for Kremlin games since his eldest son Alexander had died in 2014. But again, he had to push more than once to be allowed to step away from his perch at Putin's right hand. And so it goes. Why is it so hard to leave? Now, sometimes one can find rationalizations. I mean, it's true, for example, that there's no obvious successor at the top of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs for Lavrov. And likewise, Murov's successor, General Korchnev, definitely lacks his stature. But then again, Murov didn't just simply assume that stature when he became head of the FSO a decade and a half ago. He grew into it. Now, I can't help but feel that there is something more here. It's clear Putin has a very tribal mentality. Those whom he sees as his tribe, his gang, if you want to put it in those terms, and it's not a big circle, they can do no wrong, and he will have their backs, whatever the cost. In part, let's be honest, this is likely the imprint of the young teenage Putin, the kid living a pretty hard scrabble life in post-war Leningrad, looking for whatever gang he can find, which will provide some kind of, not just security in terms of physical, but above all, I would say, psychological. The flip side, perhaps, is that no one leaves the tribe. This isn't like a mafia clan where you may not let people leave because they know too much. No, rather it's about his own insecurities. He trusts too few people to be willing to let them go. So much of Putin's life and even his politics are about trying to find, build and protect zones of security for an ultimately insecure man. Now, so what? Well, the point about security is obviously a much broader one that also speaks to the whole question of, for example, Russian foreign policy ambitions and activities. Very much a sense of security in a dangerous and unstable world. It may also speak to the reasons quite why he's so unable to relinquish power or even contemplate it, given that when he does so, he also relinquishes the security that that power provides. But more broadly, I think it helps explain the degeneration of Russian policymaking that I've described before. If Putin is unwilling to let his old guys go, the corollary is that he's going to find it harder to allow new guys into his circle, to allow some kind of transfusion of new blood. Is he, at this point in his life and career, willing and able to let new people into his tribe? And if not, do the existing members have what it takes to advise him, to inform him, to serve him as he needs? I would suggest not. And such a personal psychological factors are as important as the wider pressures of political evolution and economic change and so forth in explaining what is going on in the shadowed heart of the Kremlin. But let's be honest, if I'm playing popular psychologist, it's probably time to let Putin off the couch and bring this particular episode of the podcast to an end. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/InMoscowShadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well.